Ask the average evangelical about infant baptism, and they are likely to emphatically tell you that is a man-made doctrine, man-made practice. The Bible nowhere teaches it, and the Bible does not tell us to baptize our infants. Is this true?
Chris Roseborough of Fighting for the Faith talking about his presentation at the Fall 2018 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
We'll be opening up the scriptures and looking at who the scriptures say baptism is for. We'll take a look at the doctrine of original sin and how it relates to infant baptism. And we'll also take a look at the benefits of baptism, who's doing the work, and even take a look at a biblical account of baptismal regeneration.
You can meet and hear Chris Roseborough making the case for infant baptism at the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, November 9th and 10th in Dallas, Texas. Learn more at issuesetc.org. I don't know if it's a combination of the medium that is social media, the tribalism that seems to pervade our culture today when it comes to politics, or that there's a religion at work out there that uses both that medium and that tribalism, a religion that pursues a kind of righteousness, maybe even a righteousness before God. And how it does it is, well, by chiming in, by throwing in your 2 cents, even if your 2 cents aren't worth 2 cents, expressing your opinion. Sometimes that's enough. That's just enough to get you through. What is that compelling need that we have to comment, even when we don't know what we're talking about? Joining us to talk about political ignorance and social media, Pastor Hans Feeney. He joins us this Friday. He's pastor of River of Life Lutheran Church in Shanahan, Illinois. He's creator of a series of comical videos called Lutheran Satire. And he's senior contributor to The Federalist and author of a recent column titled, If You Don't Know Enough About Politics, Don't Tweet or Vote. Hans, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
You have been for some time now kind of laying out a thesis on a religion, when religion comes to politics, and how in the realm of politics, in your words, people pursue righteousness through their political opinions and ideas. Lay that out for us again.
Yeah, so yeah, I think when I spoke at the Issues Etc. conference a couple months ago, that this was sort of the main center of my topic was basically the idea that people are by nature seeking out justification. They want to know how they are made righteous with God. That's the center thing in all of our lives, even though we come to vastly different ideas as to how we accomplish that righteousness. And I think when it comes to the political realm, I think the reason oftentimes this happens so much in politics is because man is sort of hardwired to imagine that salvation is either found or lost through really big acts. So you'll oftentimes hear people kind of talk about this, things like this, where they'll say, well, I'm not perfect, but you know, I've never killed anyone. So they imagine the only thing that could really send you to hell is a big sin like murder. And conversely, they tend to sort of think, well, the only things that are sort of worthy of giving you real absolute confidence in salvation and the idea that you're a truly good person is by really big acts of goodness and righteousness. And, you know, most of us are not going to, you know, dive on a grenade for someone else. And most of us just in our average everyday lives don't really have that much power and influence in the world, you know. So you can very easily destroy someone's life by murdering someone that they love. But it's very hard to build up and create a wonderful thing in someone's life, especially if you don't know them. And so politics, I think, becomes really attractive to people of that mindset, because the idea is basically if you get to elect the leaders, and the leaders, especially in the United States, get to do really big things that have a lot of influence in the world and can really affect people's lives, then by virtue of that, you are doing that as well, that you're responsible for that. And so if you can elect the right people and get the right people into positions of power and change the laws that can do great and wonderful things and that can hinder evil people, whatever your conception of evil people is, if you can do that, then that's the kind of big, huge, enormous stuff that's clearly going to make you worthy of eternal life in the eyes of God.
You write about tribalism. How do you use that word? What does it mean?
Yeah, tribalism, I think, at least in this context for me, is the idea that basically that everyone just kind of falls into one of two camps. And you don't even really have to like the people who are on your side. You just have to recognize that if you have the same kind of general overall objective, that's your people. And by virtue of the fact that the other side is going to show up to vote, by virtue of the fact that the other side is going to be engaged in this battle, you got to just simply do your tribal duty. So I think you heard this a lot during the last presidential election when a lot of conservatives, conservative Christians in particular, voiced a lot of hesitation about Donald Trump and his moral failings and, you know, certainly questions at that point about his commitment to issues like the pro-life cause. And where you had a lot of people saying, look, you got to just suck it up and vote for him because the other side's going to come up and they're going to show up and they're not hindered by, you know, moral qualms about supporting immoral people. So you got to just do your tribal duty. You owe it to all of us because they're going to come for us if, you know, if we're not all kind of united. That's sort of how I would define tribalism, is basically the idea that you are just obligated to people who have the same general desires as you, and that you have to do the things that are of benefit to all of you, or they're of benefit to the tribe, at least as the tribe so defines it.
So how do you explain the fact that regardless of how little we may understand about a subject, we feel this impulse to throw in our two cents, especially on social media?
Yeah, I think what's kind of happened is, part of it is just people, when tribalism, when it comes about, the problem is that people always sort of want validation. So a lot of times, people sort of overuse the term virtue signaling, but I think a lot of times that's, you know, probably a better term for that is seeking tribal affirmation. So you can, you know, virtue signaling I think oftentimes means you don't really care that much about these things. You just want people to think that you're a moral, upstanding person. I think it's a little bit different than that, in that people do genuinely believe this stuff, but they get sort of really aggressive about it, or they spout off about stuff that they know is kind of connected, but they don't know that much about it, simply because they want to show that they are devout and committed to kind of the tribal cause. So I think, in a lot of ways, I think that is that's the one of the main problems at hand. I think I may have lost sight of your original question, though.
Well, so it sounds like you're saying our impulse to chime in and to throw in our two cents, regardless of how little we may know about a subject, may have nothing to do with the subject whatsoever. It may simply be us, hoisting the tribe's flag.
Right, yeah, and likewise, on top of that, I think, and this is where I think I was also going with this, is that we've bought into the idea that we have to do this in order to keep our tribe from getting gobbled up with the other one. You know, so if the other side is screaming about something, and it doesn't really even matter what that issue is, all you know is that if that issue causes them to get their way, and them getting their way is going to be bad for your side, then you got to speak up and you got to scream the opposite position. And it doesn't really even matter if you know anything about it. It doesn't matter if you have fully kind of studied that issue, or even if you care about it at all. The point is just simply that if the other side is doing this, they're going to get an upper hand. So we have to do it as well.
So I think many have observed that the medium of social media is a place where it's much easier to vent negative, the things like rage and anger, all the things you've written about extensively, than it is to celebrate anything positive. Here's a good example, and it's just simply what I observed. When the soccer team of young boys were trapped in the cave recently for those weeks, there was some genuine concern about this being expressed by many people, and rightly so. But once they were out, it's like they were never there. The story disappeared because it had a happy ending. Happy endings don't fuel social media anything like Facebook losing 14% of its value yesterday.
Right.
That's the kind of stuff we really want to hear about.
Yeah, I know. I think that's very true. It's sort of like, I think the best analogy for this would be that my friend Brian Wolfmuller will make fun of me for this because I always use high school relationship analogies. I think you've made fun of me for that too, but that's fine. But so it's sort of like if you're a high school girl in 1995 and a guy breaks up with you, and you could listen to happy Stevie Wonder love songs, but you're mad and angry and it doesn't give you any sort of sense of relief to do that, so you just want to listen to angry Alanis Morissette songs. And it's sort of like that's just the mood of everyone in the nation, at least on social media. That's just kind of what social media produces, is it's just, it feels better to be miserable. No one really, you know, Twitter's especially this way. Other websites, you know, stuff like Instagram, I think, is a little bit more, here are happy pictures of, you know, my kids playing and a, you know, vanilla sundae that I had recently. But Twitter especially, and Facebook to a lesser extent, is, it just kind of thrives off of anger, because it, that just seems to sort of be what we're all kind of trying to vent. Yeah, and so I think the problem with anger, too, is that because, you know, one of the things I think we haven't adjusted to yet as a society, and I am still optimistic that we will get there eventually, is that Twitter is that the world around us is treating what happens on Twitter as though it's real, and as though it needs, we need to respond to the things and to the outrage that happens there. I'm optimistic that eventually people will just sort of say, no, that's not going to work. It has to happen in real life in order for this to be a thing. But on account of that, what's happened is that getting angry and getting outraged and trying to get people fired from their jobs for things that they've said online, it works. At this current present juncture, it is an effective strategy for derailing pieces of legislation that you don't like, and especially for silencing the voices of people that you don't like. You know, so that's how Roseanne Barr recently lost her show. It's how it is that James Gunn, who's the director of the Guardians of the Galaxy movies, got fired from doing the third film. So people kind of on either sides, the anger works. And so the problem with that is that because online outrage is yielding political and cultural and tribal goals, people see it as an extension of voting. That if you have a civic, and but more accurately, if you have a tribal duty to stop the bad guys on election day, it doesn't really end on election day. You have to keep doing that afterwards, and the other side is going to do it, so you don't have the luxury of sitting back and saying, well, you know, this is sort of below us to try and take people down for, you know, mean things that they said online. If the other side is going to eviscerate you on account of this, you got to do it back. And that just yields this big sort of sewer of anger.
One of the things I've noted, and I'm gratified to see you write about this in The Federalist, that sometimes political ignorance, not knowing about, for instance, nowadays, what the implications of tariffs may be. My daughter asked me about it the other day. Her husband works in an industry very close to the steel industry. And I said, I don't know. I don't have any time to look into that. You say it's sometimes just simply evidence of the fact that you might have had better things, truly better things to do.
Right, yeah. So the whole point is, I mean, everyone, I think objectively most people would say you don't want uninformed people voting. But the problem is that you can never really agree on who is uninformed. And then, of course, the other problem is that if the other side, if they're uninformed people are going to vote, then you got to make sure that yours vote too, so that you don't, you know, so that you don't lose the election and all of that. So on the one hand, I think, you know, people sort of recognize this. On the other hand, because voting has become so tribal, we've developed this idea that you just got to show up, and it doesn't really matter if you don't know things and you got to vote. But then on top of that, we still have this guilt over, well, you should know things. And so it kind of creates this problem where people feel like, well, I'm going to be a bad member of the tribe if I don't show up and if I don't vote, but I don't know what is going on. I don't understand these issues. And we haven't really made a lot of room to just sort of say to people, sometimes it's okay if you don't know. I mean, so as I say in the piece, look, if the reason you don't understand anything about politics, if the reason you don't know anything about trade or foreign policy is because you're getting high for 40 hours a week and watching, you know, Banana Man reruns on TV, then okay, fine, you're a bad person, you need to repent, and you need to make better use of the gifts that God has given you. But if you're using the gifts that God has given you to be a good worker, and you're working hard for 40 hours a week, and you're taking care of your children, and you're loving your wife, and you're putting food on their table and a roof over their head, and if you come home from work at the end of the day and you're working hard and you'd rather play board games with your kids or go for a walk with your wife, then you would sit down and, you know, read through, you know, bills that have been proposed or read books on boring subjects. You don't have to. It's fine. You don't have to do that stuff. If you just kind of got behind the eight ball in life and you haven't really been able to get a mastery of these political topics, and if there's a good chance you could make the world a worse place by voting as an uninformed person, then just don't do it. You don't have to. You're not obligated to. It's fine to not know this stuff. You don't. If you're occupying yourself with greater and better vocations, and the vocation of father is better than the vocation of voter, the vocation of worker and husband and all this, and Christian, these are higher vocations than showing up on election day. And so if the reason you are unqualified to take on the vocation of voter is because you've been fulfilling those other vocations, then relax. It's fine. You don't have anything to apologize for.
Pastor Hans Feeney is pastor of River of Life Lutheran Church in Shanahan, Illinois. He's creator of a series of comical videos called Lutheran Satire and senior contributor to The Federalist. He's author there of a recent column titled, If You Don't Know Enough About Politics, Don't Tweet or Vote. You can read it for yourself at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Hans, thank you very much.
Thank you, Sue.
In Hour 2 of Issues, Etc., we will remember 18th century composer and cantor Johann Sebastian Bach, quite a theologian too. The church will remember him on the 28th of July. Dr. Daniel Zager will be our guest. Then we're going to play Issues, Etc., Soundbite of the Week.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
Hi, this is Pastor Clayton from Zion Lutheran Church of Muscoota, Illinois, a proud supporter of Issues Etc. Zion is a congregation firmly grounded in God's grace given in the Word and Sacraments, where we treasure the timeless beauty of the liturgy. Zion is also a vibrant, young, family-friendly congregation where you would be warmly welcomed. Zion is located at 101 South Railway Street in Muscoota, Illinois, and we would love to share God's gifts of grace with you. For more information, please visit our website at zionmuscoota.com.
Hey, Todd, what have our listeners noticed first when visiting the LPR studios?
Definitely the small size and the dirt.
Well, not anymore. Thanks to our friends at the Cleaning Authority. They've turned this man cave into a space that meets even our wives' approval.
Whether it's our office or your home, the Cleaning Authority is your cleaning service provider in the St. Louis area.
To schedule a free estimate or to find out more, visit thecleaningauthority.com. thecleaningauthority.com.